Good evening, you're listening to Resonance FM and this is Little Atoms, with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation. And our guest tonight is the journalist and writer Philippe Legrain, who Padre is now going to introduce.
Philippe Legrain is a journalist and writer based in London but interested in the whole world. He is fascinated by how economics, politics and culture combine to form the big picture, and how the world is coming together through globalization while becoming ever more diverse through cultural mixing and individual choice. Philippe writes primarily about globalization, migration and European issues. A visiting fellow at the European Institute at the London School of Economics, he followed up his first book, Open World, Truth About Globalization, with his new one, Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them, making the case for freer internal migration. Internal migration, are we talking about... Is that within the state?
It should be international migration.
International, it should be, shouldn't it?
It is international migration. It's just the whole point of the word immigration is such a loaded word.
Yeah,
I mean, it suggests that it's all outsiders coming in. It's one way traffic, the very word immigrant has almost become a term of abuse now. The proper word is international migration. The problem is that when you talk about that, people think you're talking about birds. That in itself is indicative, you know, because it's the whole way that we look at it is completely, you know, it's a sort of very narrow, nationalistic and negative perspective. I wanted to, when I published the book, that my publisher said you have to have the word, you know, immigration. You can't have migration on the cover, otherwise it just won't sell. So, you know, you have to go with what the word people use. But but as I said, it's a loaded word now.
We tend to confuse issues of economic migration and migration on basis of rights or, you know, asylum seeking. And generally, the way it's presented is that asylum seeking, the way it's presented by more progressive evidence is that asylum seeking is perfectly legitimate, but economic migration isn't. Do you seek to redress that kind of balance?
Let me be clear. I think that it's incredibly important that people fleeing persecution are able to leave their country and to take sanctuary in another. I mean, that's the lesson of the Second World War and history before that, if people can't escape, that often they end up dying. And it's a pity that even that most basic of rights is often infringed by this government and by others. But where I part company is in saying that, you know, fleeing persecution is the only legitimate reason why people might want to cross borders. I think, except where you can show catastrophic consequences, that people should be able to move across borders freely. That the freedom to move is a fundamental human right. There's a strange paradox, because if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in Article 13 says that everyone has a right to leave a country, including their own. But that right is actually devoid of meaning unless you're actually able to enter another one. And I don't really think really the motive really matters. I mean, whether you're going to be with the person you love, whether you're going there to work, whether you're just going there to experience a different country, I don't see it really matters what your motive is, as long as there aren't catastrophic consequences from you moving. And I don't think there are in the overwhelming majority of cases. I think that people should be able to move freely.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the argument that comes up frequently of that migration to European countries, prosperous European countries, causes a drain on, particularly in professions, doctors, nurses, academics, so on, of leaving poor countries, thereby condemning these countries to a shortfall in educated people?
I think in some cases it's true that some countries are suffering a brain drain, and in particular, that's particularly true of African countries, small island states, which have a deficit of doctors. But, I mean, the World Health Organization did analysis of the issue, and they showed actually that even though there's a global shortage of 4 million doctors, that actually the brain drain from developing countries actually only accounted for 12% of the shortage of doctors in Africa. What does that mean? It means basically that Africa is desperately short of doctors in any case, and the fact that some of them choose to leave is actually only a small part of the problem. So if we're actually looking at the problem in the main, we ought to be saying, well, first of all, worldwide, we ought to be training more doctors. Second of all, we ought to be allocating some of the aid that we give African governments to paying higher wages for doctors and nurses, so that they're more likely to stay at home. Thirdly, that we're giving aid in order to help combat the diseases which require so much medical care, mm-hmm. AIDS, malaria, and so on. But at the end of it, though, even if there is a cost to African countries from doctors leaving, I don't think that a country has an automatic right to the labour of its citizens. And I don't think that just because someone is a doctor, you can say, no, you're not allowed to leave your country and go elsewhere. If you happen to be unfortunate enough to be in Zimbabwe and your country is falling apart, now it's true that if you leave, Zimbabwe is probably even worse off than before. But who are you to say, well, no, you have to stay in Zimbabwe because you're a doctor? I don't think that that's tenable. As I said, it certainly violates Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And therefore, I think that, irrespective of it, people should be allowed to leave. I mean, you take a British example. If you're born in a Welsh village, Welsh villages suffer brain drain all the time. The brightest and best move to London or Cardiff or wherever. And now you can say that's probably, harmful for the Welsh village, but few people would say, actually, even if just because you're bright, you're not allowed to leave the village in which you're born.
Can we step back a bit before we get too deep into some of the issues around migration, which you called a... you sort of said is now a sort of loaded term, and another loaded term is globalization to a lot of people on the left. And as this program and certainly this radio station, a lot of its listeners would think that was the case. And we'll be talking about globalization as being the free movement of goods and sort of services and the sort of paradox that we don't at the minute allow the free movement of people and how strange. But let's just talk about, first of all, why do you think the very concept of globalization is such an anathema to large parts of the sort of liberal left? And further on from that, if those sort of people claim that globalization is sort of exploiting the third world, let's go on to talk about how globalization can actually help the world's poor.
Right. Well, I mean, why is globalization such an anathema? I think to a large extent it's because globalization means different things to different people. And to a certain extent it's become a catchphrase for everything you dislike about the way the world is today. And I think if you look at actually on the specific issues which the word refers to, that actually you find a diversity of views which aren't the same. I think it's certainly true that globalization is completely unbalanced. As you pointed out, goods and services move across borders more or less freely. Capital moves almost entirely freely. Ideas move around ever more easily. But people are most people, apart from the rich and the highly educated, are expected to stay put. And I think it's absolutely right to point out that's unbalanced and that's harmful and that's unfair. In terms of the benefits that globalization can have for developing countries, I think you just have to look at the fact the way that China and India are at the moment catching up with the West, despite the huge disadvantages that they start with, and the fact that you're seeing the fastest fall in poverty in history. Now, does that mean that people are suffering and that it's a nasty, dirty process? Yes, of course it is. But it's a bit like the Industrial Revolution was in this country, which is, as people leave the land and move into factories, it's a wrenching process that tears society apart, which leads to a lot of suffering, but at the end of the day leads to the society we have now. And most people will agree that however many flaws there are with British society now, It's a much better place, and nearly everyone is better off than they were, say, 200 years ago. And I think what you're seeing in China is similar to that. And I think there's a kind of a false debate, which is to say either you have globalization or you have environmental protection. Either you have globalization or you have labor standards. And I think you can have both, and I don't think there's any inconsistency between having them. At a more broad level, people think, you know, that globalization is the triumph of markets everywhere and that it has no place for government. And I fundamentally disagree with that. You know, probably the most globalized economy in the world, one of the most globalized economy in the world is Sweden. And Sweden taxes half its citizens' income, has, you know, the welfare state, which is the envy of the world. And at the same time, its companies sell all over the world, and it's completely open to the world market. So I don't think there's an inconsistency between that. And I think if people realise that, perhaps they wouldn't be as afraid of globalisation as they are.
So let's broaden this out then. If we, I mean, most countries, all countries have border controls and some sort of limits on movement. So what would be the benefits, do you think, of sort of completely relaxing those?
Well, I think, you know, we ought to be looking at the whole discourse about migration is completely, is either negative or defensive. And I think we much ought to be turning it around and look at it from a positive perspective, which is to say, first of all, if you believe in freedom and opportunity, there is no single other measure that governments could take to enhance people's freedom and opportunity than relaxing our border controls. And in effect, as I said, we have a system of global apartheid of, you know, some people are able to move freely and some people are able to stay put. And just as, you know, in the 19th century, the battle to abolish slavery was the great moral cause of the time, I think that one of the great moral causes of our time is the battle to allow people to move freely. So that's the first point. In terms of, you know, the broader benefits, I think you know economic studies suggest that actually abolishing border controls would double the size of the world economy, and that's an astonishing figure. And the reason for that, the sort of intuition behind that, is that when people from developing countries move to rich countries, they're able to take advantage of the better capital, institutions, technology available here, and that makes them more productive and makes the world as a whole better off. And you just have to see already now, even with our very limited migration that we have now, even with the very high border controls, you see that, you know, migrants who come to live in Britain end up, you know, several times better off than they were back home. You see the money that they send home, called remittances, amounts to, say, $300 billion a year, perhaps twice that unofficially. And that compares to only $100 billion that Western governments give in aid. It compares to only $200 billion that developing countries get in foreign direct investment. It's the single biggest resource transfer to developing countries. And you see, well, you know, this money keeps kids in school, it helps pay for medicines, it helps pay for clean water, it helps start new businesses, it reduces poverty, it reduces child labour. It's the best kind of overseas aid that you can imagine. And, you know, that's an absolutely massive benefit. And if you believe that the world is unfair and that we ought to be creating a fairer globalisation, a fairer world, then you ought to be campaigning in favour of freer migration. And one of the disappointing things is that so many people who believe in international solidarity are in favour of helping people so long as they remain at a safe distance. And I think that's a great pity because, as I said, opening our borders could do more to help the poor than any other measure that you can think of. But also, I think it's in terms of you know, British society, not only because it would make British society richer, but because it's about creating an open, dynamic and progressive society instead of a closed, stagnant and reactionary one. And you just have to look at, you know, the views and the assumptions of the people who oppose migration to see that basically, you know, their vision of the world is that there is a single way of Britain being British, which is, you know, all white, a single set of values, which, you know, remarkably are just like their own, and that the other, the foreigner, is a threat to that. And, you know, my vision of a good society is a diverse, a pluralistic society. It's a dynamic society. It's a society that is open rather than a gated community living in fear, building ever higher barriers to keep out the barbarians at the gates.
But would that also mean then that the sort of the very idea of nationality and not just not borders, but, you know, the cultural nationalities was sort of blurred as well, that sort of idea should eventually sort of dissipate?
I think, you know, the whole idea of nationality is a bit overplayed. I mean, the reality is that within Britain, there's a huge diversity. You know, there are Marxists, there are libertarians. You know, there are gay people, there are straight people, there are radical environmentalists, and there are oil executives. And that within all of us, we all have multiple and overlapping identities. You know, you can be British, of Irish origin, Christian, a Londoner, a father, a supporter of gay rights, an Arsenal fan, and so on. And the idea that there's a kind of single, a national British identity, I think is a complete fallacy. Having said that, you know, it is pretty clear that immigration and, you know, globalization more generally, the greater openness to the rest of the world is changing Britain, is changing our perception of ourselves. That, you know, any notion this was an ethnically homogeneous nation, which was, you know, false in any case, is, you know, ever more palpably so. That clearly there is greater diversity than before, and I would say that's a good thing. Does that mean that there can not still be some sense of British nationhood? Well, I think, you know, insofar as people live in the same place, insofar as they vote in the same elections, insofar as they use the same national health service, insofar as they watch the same television and read similar papers and listen to similar radio programs, or, you know, just chat about EastEnders, that, you know, you have some kind of common bond from that. And I would say it should not be an exclusive bond. It should not be a bond that defines itself as saying, you know, we are better or we are different than outsiders. But, you know, that real bonds can exist among people.
Well, you mentioned sharing common experiences of reading the same newspapers, watching the same telly, that kind of thing. That would suggest that there is, because, you know, living where I do, I mean, you do very much get the Polish newspapers, and you get the Urdu newspapers and the Hindi newspapers, and then the vast majority of people do have satellite dishes on which they will watch Turkish football or they will watch something else. Is there a danger that, what I'm getting at really is there some obligation to some kind of integration, or is that thus some conscious effort should be made on both sides, from the supposedly native, for want of a better word, community, and from the migrant community, should there be a conscious effort towards integration, or is it something that just emerges organically? Because it ties in with we're suddenly, Gordon Brown spent a lot of last year talking about defining Britishness. I don't think necessarily in a negative way, not in a fortress way, but there was a very clear government idea that we must create a rallying point. And can that be just created, or is it something that will just emerge?
Well, I would say integration into what, as I said. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what is this sort of a model of Britishness that people are expected to conform to? And I would say more generally, I mean, if you're going to apply specific requirements to migrants, then they ought to be applied to British people as a whole. If you say that people ought to mix, then you ought to say, well, rich people who live in Chelsea have to mix with poor people who live in Peckham, and we don't see any government proposing that. So I would say, you know, yes, I mean, there is a danger if we live in a society where people don't interact with people who are different from each other. I think that is a society which that is an issue which is posed more generally. But focusing it on as a specific requirement of people who either come from overseas or in general, actually, is even applied to people within Britain who just happen to be, you know, non-white or of a different religion. Mm-hmm. Than the majority, and said, you specifically must integrate, you specifically must conform to the ways of the mainstream. Well, you know, no. I mean, I don't think that that's... I don't think that there should be that requirement. I think that as long as people respect the law, live within the law, the broad, huge range of diversity should not just be tolerated but cherished.
In the book, Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them, you talk about some of the myths that people, sort of the points that people have against the concept of migration, and I want to perhaps dispel some of those. So if we could perhaps go through a couple of those. The first one I'd like to tackle is, there's only so many jobs to go around.
Yeah, I mean, that's the oldest myth around. And it's very funny the way that, you know, people who apparently are intelligent seem to subscribe to it. You know, Gordon Brown himself in his party conference speech was talking about British jobs for British workers as if there was a fixed number of jobs to go around. And the reality, of course, is that people don't just take jobs, they also create them. And we heard, when women started entering the labour force in large numbers, many men said, well, if women start working, there'll be no jobs for us men. And the reality, of course, is now most women work, and so do most men. The problem with immigration is that the jobs that immigrants take, are very visible, and the job that they create are much less visible, i.e. the jobs which are created when they spend their wages, which creates extra demand for British workers producing the things that they consume. Well, those extra jobs aren't visible. Likewise, the extra jobs that they create through their work are less visible. So if you think about it, the Polish builders who created extra jobs for British people selling building supplies, as well as British interior designers. But again, that connection is not made. You just see the Polish builder you see the job that he, inverted commas, takes, but you don't see the jobs that he creates. More generally, if it was true that more people meant fewer jobs, as the population has risen sixfold over the past century, presumably we should all be unemployed, and you observe that we're not. Likewise, as immigration has risen substantially over the past 20 years, unemployment ought to have skyrocketed, and it hasn't. No matter how much you retell this story, no matter how actually, it's palpably logical that people take jobs as well as create jobs as well as taking them. It doesn't really sink in.
Okay, in the book there's some extremely vivid sort of passages describing migrants' journeys up Africa into and living in camps around the Ceuta, is it, the Spanish enclave, and people drowning and trying to get across the Mediterranean, and bodies washing up and stuff. With a country like Britain, which is it has limited resources, it's a small place, there's still going to come a tipping point where there really isn't any more jobs. And what's to sort of stop the same thing happening anyway? Because there's far more desperate people in Africa trying to get out and trying to get a better life than there ever will be in Europe in terms of the numbers. So is the same thing not just going to happen?
Well, I think, first of all, the reality is that within Africa, no state controls its borders at all. And yet some countries are much richer than others. And what you don't find, actually, is that everyone moves. You find, actually, that most people don't move, either A, because they're far too poor to move at all, or B, because they're very attached to the place where they're from, and they don't want to up sticks. And that's why you find, that people still live in Welsh mining villages where there are no jobs 20 years after the pit closed. So the notion that somehow that everyone would move if we open the borders, I think, is a complete fallacy. We've seen it more recently, with Eastern Europe, where basically everyone in Eastern Europe could move. Most everyone there does have the means to do so. 75 million people live in Poland and the other countries that joined the EU in 2004. Even by the wildest estimates of the people like Migration Watch, no more than 1 million came to this country. So that's 1 million out of 75. Now, presumably, we're such a rich, attractive country, everyone should have moved, or at least a very large proportion should have moved. And, the fact is, it wasn't. That didn't happen. So, I think that, even if we open our borders entirely, I don't think that we would be deluged with huge amounts of people. Secondly, the fact is that the people who would come would be contributing. As we described before, they would be creating jobs as well as taking them. And thirdly, that if it got to a point where actually there were no more jobs in Britain, then people would go elsewhere. And you see that already happening within the European Union now, where they do have open borders. You find that one part of the country does less well, Poles move to other parts of the country, or they go home, or they go to other countries. And so the notion that people are just going to carry on coming here if there are no economic opportunities here, again, I think is mistaken.
Okay, well, there's one of the myths then that you dispel in the book, and I've only got a couple of minutes left, and I'm keen to dispel this one particularly because it is rather self-evidently ludicrous. But people often say that immigrants are coming in basically to scrounge off the state and take advantage of our NHS and stuff. So let's talk about that for a while.
I mean, I find that's an astonishing thing. I mean, you know, at the moment it costs about £5,000 to be smuggled from Afghanistan into Britain. Now the notion that you're going to leave your country behind, be smuggled into this country for £5,000 in order to claim £56 a week in job seekers' allowance is, you know, far-fetched and ludicrous. More generally, if you're the sort of person who is, you know, risk-taking enough, adventurous enough to leave your country behind to go and seek out a better life in a strange and foreign land, the notion that when you get to this country you're suddenly sapped of enterprise and become a lazy good-for-nothing is frankly, you know, ludicrous. The fact is, despite what people think, there is no evidence that people do move. It is true that some people who end up coming here end up unemployed or end up on benefits, and the reason for that is not generally that people are lazy or don't want to work. It's that often they suffer discrimination. It's just often that there are there are two kinds of immigration controls. There are border controls, and there are barriers which prevent people entering the labour market once they get here. And the notion that because you see high unemployment among some immigrant groups that people are lazy, I think is completely false.
I think that's a really good point to end on. So, Philippe, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.